Hello, it's Thursday, July the 15th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Job vacancies are up again, another sign the economy is getting back on its feet after the pandemic. The British company at the forefront of energy research, which could make a major difference in the battle against climate change. The children's mobile phone games, which could be running up bills of more than £1,000 in 1 hour. All parents, please take note. But first, a snack tax has been proposed by a report commissioned by the government, but already it seems cabinet ministers are disowning it. So Britain should introduce a snack tax to curb the nation's addiction to unhealthy food, but it could add about £3.4 billion a year to food bills. This is according to the new report. Poor diets are now contributing to up to 64,000 deaths every year in England. They cost the economy an estimated £74 billion. That's according to the National Food Strategy Report by Henry Dimbleby, who, of course, owns the Lyon chain of restaurants. I'm joined now by the author and journalist, Rose Prince. Rose, it seems to me, whether or not you think this report is good or not, it seems the government is about to ditch it. Robert Jenrick, the community secretary, was on the radio today, and I heard the distinct sound of a government washing its hands of a report because they say they don't want to be seen to be a government that's making food more expensive for poorer people.
Well, then they've completely misunderstood the purpose of the tax, because Henry Dimbleby has insisted that having happened before with the first sugar tax, that there was a distinct change in shopping habits, and secondly, that the industry adapted, reduced sugar in some of their products, so the tax was not to be put on those ones. And so in this case, they are sending a strong message to the industry, which is get the salt out.
Yes.
Put the better ingredients in so you don't need so much salt, and go ahead and sell your food. They're not trying to pass it on to the consumer. If the industry pass it on to the consumer's not a fool.
Right.
I think they'll just say, well, fine, you know, we realise that actually rather like it's happened before with drinking a packet of cigarettes. You've got to think whether you should actually eat so much of this.
And we saw it with the sugar tax on fizzy drinks. I mean, the manufacturers, I'd never seen them move so quickly to get the sugar content down so that their products could then avoid the tax.
Absolutely. And it is the industry who need to be targeted, because it's not fair to keep sort of making the consumer pay, and also for the consumer to remain unaware of what actually they're buying. Because if you have the sort of life where you need to buy a lot of convenience food due to time, poverty or whatever the problems are, and indeed poverty, then you kind of need to know, and also you need to be protected from the industry. It is a very cynical industry sometimes. We like to think it's our mother who feeds us, but actually I think it's far from that. And don't forget, many of these companies, make enormous sums of money out of producing this food. And you see, they're always looking at how they can produce it cheaper and sell it for more. So I think one has to kind of, this is very informative for people. I think it really sort of highlights a problem.
Yeah, and Henry Dimbleby did say, didn't he? He says he's confident the tax will encourage firms to reformulate their recipes or reduce portion sizes. And he makes the point that more than half of the over 45s are now living with diet-related health conditions. You know, Rose, I was talking about this the other day. When I was at school in the 60s and 70s, there were two fat kids in the entire school, and everybody knew their name. And of course, those poor lads were ribbed mercilessly. Now we hear that the majority of children leaving infant school are often overweight, and quite a lot of them already obese.
That's absolutely right. And the tragedy is that if in the preschool years you don't tackle the problem becomes very difficult to reverse, which is why it's so important to involve parents in schemes for eating well when they're pregnant, or when, their children are infants, because that's where it begins. And I was interested to see that and part of this report and the plan is that there will be additional funds for doctors to give, it's vouchers, for families to buy more fresh produce, more fresh vegetables and fruit.
Yeah, fantastic.
Which is a great idea. Mm. And it's nice if it comes from the doctor, because no one's saying it's a benefit to kind of reduce people to an embarrassment. It's just your doctor saying, listen, this is available. Do you want it? And I think people mostly go, yeah, thanks a lot, actually, because I find these things very expensive. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, going back to, you know, I completely agree with you. I think you and I have a similar age. But I mean, when I was at school, there was one girl, I'm ashamed to say, she was called Fatty by an awful lot of people. It was unusual. I mean, we did get through an awful lot of sweets. I think probably we've got worse teeth than anything else, actually, from that age. But I do know something about you, and that is that if we're going back over these years, is that a friend of yours, who's a friend of mine, told me that you have the same waistline now that you did when you were 30.
That's absolutely true, actually. When I left school, 18, to go to work in journalism, my waist was 28. When I reached 30, it went to 30, and it's still 30. And the trousers I'm wearing today are 30-inch waist.
And the secret is?
I'm very careful about what I eat. I always have been. There's no cake or biscuits in my house. Drink lots of water, and I do a lot of exercise.
Well, sort of, but do you have allow yourself treats?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
And I think that this sort of goes back to this this whole issue, is that you look at the, I'm looking at the Daily Mail spread today on it.
Yeah.
And you've got McVitie's chocolate biscuits and Walker's Crisps and Mars bars and donuts. I mean, for me, a donut is a really, really, a very rare event. And I'm not saying I'm slim, and that's part of the reason why. But I do regard sweet things as treats. But it's kind of important to emphasise that this shouldn't be like a regular thing, and that our habits, you know, have become, I mean, look, this is a country where you can buy anything. I mean, you know, I think I added to my piece that it's important to really start a proper campaign, a media campaign, by the government, using the very talented commercials people, and to get them to do a really proper public health campaign, because, you know, there's so much information put out there, even like a 1 minute showing how very quickly to make a economic dish for four people out of, you know, store cupboard or anything you can get from the corner shop. You know, these things can be done. They've just got to get their imaginative heads on.
Absolutely.
We don't want to see any more politicians jogging, please. If I see one more politician jogging, I mean, I really will. I'll just go and eat a donut.
Yes, quite. Especially Boris, because he doesn't look good in his jogging gear.
No.
That's the author and journalist Rose Prince, who's written a fantastic piece about this in the paper today, talking about the National Food Strategy Report. Thanks for joining us. So visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. If your child is happily playing a game on their iPhone, you may perhaps check and see what sort of app they're playing on, because some parents have discovered during the course of an hour children running up bills of more than £1,000. This is because the gaming companies are changing the way they profit from their games. Often free to download, they instead have in-game purchases. I'm joined now by Claire Dunn, who's the Director of External Affairs at Parent Zone. Claire, can you explain technically how they've changed this, which is why so many parents have been caught completely unawares about how much their kids have run up in bills without their knowledge?
Yes, as you say, games are no longer bought complete on a disc. They're downloaded, often for free, from the internet. And that means that the gaming companies have ongoing opportunities to try to persuade gamers to spend money on things like upgrade, updates, and in-game purchases. And they use psychological techniques to try to persuade people to spend money in online games, similar to those used in the gambling industry. For example, there are tactics that would exploit the fact that gamers are more likely to keep spending if they're told they're only one or two steps away from winning. They might be given a reward and then being threatened with it being taken away. Or in a situation where the player is running out of moves or lives in a game, they might be rescued by a pop-up offering a way out, but only if you spend some money. And a specific example of the kind of new purchases we're talking about is something called loot boxes. These are virtual treasure chests that contain undisclosed items that can be used in the game. So you don't know what you're buying before you buy the loot box, but there might be things like ways of customizing a character in a game, something that can help you progress through the game or give you some status. So the fact that you really don't know what you're getting until you spend the money encourages a kind of gambling-like behavior. And the techniques that games are using to promote these are all derived from the gambling.
Yeah, and of course, so children can click on every in-game purchasing option. They won't have a clue, of course, what it's costing.
Absolutely. And that lack of a link between spending in a virtual world and the real world value is absolutely one of the tactics and techniques that's used.
What are parents? What is your advice to parents? Because clearly this is going to become very problematic. In the Mail today, they've highlighted one chap who, Mr. Mohammed Mataz, whose son rung up £1,300 in an hour. He complained. His son was only 7 years old. 7 years old, for heaven's sake, and run up a bill of £1,300. And all the app people gave, the game people gave him back was £200. So what's your advice to parents to prevent them getting into that mess in the first place?
I think the best thing that parents and carers can do is to stay informed and engaged about the kind of things their child is doing online. So that includes talking to your child about the games they're playing, and if they'll let you to play their games alongside them, or separately to them if that works better. And parents can also find out information about online games from organisations like Parents Own and others working in the sector. So really kind of doing some research into the games. And that might include looking for ways to turn off some of those spending features if they're available. It's also really useful for parents and carers to talk to their children about the kind of techniques that might be used in the games to encourage them to spend money around those kind of in-game purchases we've just described, and really encourage their children to come and talk to their parents or another trusted adult as soon as possible if they think they've accidentally made a purchase. So really being open, informed and engaged is a really good model across your child's online life more generally, not just gaming.
And just finally on that, I mean, the parents, obviously a lot of the pressure is on the parents, but don't these wretched online game people have a responsibility? Because I know Parents Own has described the fact that what they do, they're using dark nudge techniques and they're ensnaring children as young as 6 and 7. I think it's shameful.
So parents, of course, take their own responsibilities towards their children very seriously, but the problem, as you describe, is far bigger than an individual child and their parents. And it's absolutely not appropriate or fair for parents to bear the brunt of the responsibility. There's absolutely a limit on what parents can do. The kind of payments and purchases and these psychological techniques are baked into the online gaming industry business model. And many of the games themselves are marketed to children. So the companies that develop and market these games have a responsibility to make sure that the content of those games are suitable for children. And introducing gambling techniques and encouraging ongoing spending of money within those games is not something parents or wider society would expect to see.
All right, that's Claire Dunn. She's Director of External Affairs at Parents Own. Thanks so much for joining us. You can visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at ToryBoyPierce. A British company is at the forefront of research into an energy breakthrough which could potentially end the climate crisis. Tokamak Energy, a British company based near Oxford, is a world leader with a reactor based on nuclear fusion, the process that makes stars burn. Now, harnessing the power has been the energy technology sector's holy grail since the 1930s. The Mail's David Rose went to see the Tokamak reactor for himself. David, it's nuclear fusion, the process that makes stars burn. What did this fusion machine even look like to begin with?
Well, what you basically see, you go into this industrial unit near Didcot. It's a massive, great sort of hangar. And in the middle, surrounded in a sort of concrete box, because when the thing is on, there is a small radiation output, is this steel containment vessel, which is inside, it's about 6 feet in diameter, basically the shape of a cored apple. Outside, it's rather bigger than that because it's got very thick steel surrounding it and this sort of cage of incredibly powerful magnets and then loads of sensors and beams and wires and cables. It's unbelievably high tech. And of course, I was talking to some of the scientists working on this, and I got to say, these are some of the smartest people I've met in my life. Mm. Because they really have made staggering progress towards what has been, as you say, for many years, the holy grail of energy science. If you can harness nuclear fusion, you have a pretty much limitless source of energy. The basic fuel is hydrogen made from seawater. It leaves no radioactive waste, and People have been saying for years, well, yes, it's great, but it's always at least 50 years away. It's a pipe dream. Well, these guys have made real progress, and it's starting to look like it may not be a pipe dream at all.
How far away do you think they are then, David, from not just cracking it, but actually making it commercially available?
Well, they say that by the late 2030s, they hope to have a production line making a commercial model. Reactors that will generate 150 megawatts net output. In other words, the energy that they use to power the thing will be 150 megawatts less than what it puts out. And they say that they will have a prototype which will demonstrate this within about 6 or 7 years. Now, this is a very ambitious target, and it's far more ambitious than any other team working on fusion. Jeff Bezos, for example, says he wants to set up a fusion thing, but he hasn't really got going yet. There's a huge international project taking place, or reactor being built in the south of France on a hugely different scale. This one isn't 6 feet in diameter. It covers 60 football pitches. But that one won't even be switched on until the late 2020s on an experimental basis. So this is a very different approach. It's a small, nimble, high-tech startup with private sector capital and some government funding. But it's rapidly expanding. Now, I actually went round the company about 7 years ago when it was based somewhere else, and it was all much smaller. And they were telling me about all these big ideas they had for harnessing this technology. And I got to say, I thought, well, yeah, you talk a good game, but let's see it in action.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, now it is almost in action. I mean, well, not almost. They've still got big hurdles to cross. But for example, within just a few months, they will announce that this reactor that I saw has reached a temperature of 100 million degrees centigrade, which is more than six times as hot as the heart of the sun. To make fusion work on Earth, where you don't have the enormous pressures that you get inside a star, you need that temperature to be sustained. But they're going to do it. And I absolutely believe they're going to do that, because they're being slightly coy about just how hot they've got the thing now, but they're clearly absolutely confident that they will have a sort of verified 100 million degree temperature quite soon.
It sounds fantastic. Just finally, David, it will, if this happens, and it sounds like it will, it's going to have huge benefits for the environment.
The impact is almost unimaginably big. I mean, another leading fusion scientist who I've actually known for a while described to me how it would be every bit as big, and in many ways bigger than that sort of Wright brothers moment when they achieved heavier than air flight. If you can get commercially viable nuclear fusion, you basically solve all the world's energy problems, provided you can roll it out relatively quickly and without, you know, each reactor costing billions. You have a limitless source of clean energy. You can power as many electric vehicles, charge them up. You can have as much electrical heating. You can have planes that are powered by electricity. Essentially, global warming caused by man-made emissions in time is just over without having drastic effects on people's standard of living. You can maintain a sort of advanced industrial civilization powered by the cleanest energy imaginable with essentially free fuel. And, you know, the impact is, as I say, almost unimaginable.
That is David Rose on the Oxford Sun, another great breakthrough by British scientists. So it's now time for our regular city update with Ruth Sunderland, who is, of course, the business editor at the Daily Mail. Ruth, we've got good news, and when we've got good news, we should trumpet it. Job vacancies up again.
Yeah, so job vacancies, quite remarkable, really. They are in the 3 months to June, according to the latest data we've had from the Office for National Statistics, they're actually higher than pre-pandemic levels. So that's quite amazing when you think about everything that we've been through. So there were 862,000 jobs on offer between April and June, and that's 77,500 higher than in the equivalent period, the first 3 months, sorry, of 2020. Now, a lot of those are in hospitality and retailing, and part of that, I think, is that we've seen people maybe move out of those sectors into other lines of work. You know, perhaps they think that the future might be difficult in hospitality and retailing post-pandemic. But it's almost got to the point now where people are suffering from staff shortages, and that's hampering them from setting up and getting going again in those sectors. So it's very interesting, really. And one thing I should say as well, that compared with the unemployment rate is now 4.8%, again, very low, both historically and considering the ordeal that we've all gone through personally for the economy. That's very low and better than most of our European counterpart countries as well. So quite a positive picture all around, but we still do have 2.1 million people still on furlough.
Yeah. And I suppose when they come off furlough, what, by September, Ruth, that could see, we could see unemployment going up again.
Yeah, we could. We might see unemployment going up again. Obviously, there are vacancies that you would hope would mop up some of those people coming back. Where I think the best thing to hope for is that the economy does continue to recover in the robust way that we've seen, that we don't have reversals either on the virus statistics, the infection rates, or hospitalisation rates, or on the rate of reopening of the economy itself, because you know that's what's really going to determine the strength of the bounce is the rate of reopening, and that in turn is obviously dependent on the progress of the virus itself. So we've got to hope that when we get Freedom Day, and this long-awaited Freedom Day, that we continue with that process. And we keep hearing Andy Haldane, the Bank of England chief economist, he's moving on to another job very shortly. But he talks about this coiled spring economy that we're waiting to bounce back. There's a wall of saved cash. You know, there's a great pent-up demand and desire from people to get out there celebrating, to, you know, enjoy hospitality and enjoy shopping again. And we want to see some of that exuberance translated into economic growth.
Absolutely. That's Ruth Slundin, who is, of course, business editor at the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. In today's Daily Mail, our columnist of the year, Liz Jones, no less, donned what she describes as an empathy suit, or you could call it a fat suit, to see what life is like for a seriously overweight person. Marking the launch of her book, 8½ Stone, she found she experienced a lot of adverse judgment from other people, and she was unable to even sit properly in a cafe. Liz, I laughed out loud when I saw the photograph of you looking like a cross between... Which one was the fat one in Laurel and Hardy? The fat one in Laurel and Hardy. And
I sort of felt I looked like Demis Roussos.
Demis Roussos, that's the one. Absolutely. Yeah. So what was the reaction of people when they saw you sort of wobbling down the street?
Well, I mean, I'm used to walking down the street as an older woman and being completely invisible. Like, people just walk into me.
Yeah.
I'm also used to being a deaf person, so I'll be in a shop and I can't hear what they're saying and they just roll their eyes at me. So I'm very, very used to being shunned and invisible. But as a bigger woman, and the fat suit was about a size 46.
Yeah.
People openly looked at me with disgust. I wasn't ignored. There was open disgust from children. Women actually had the worst reaction to me than men. Men just sort of ignored me. But women were like, oh my God. No one, I was trying to open the door of Harrods. No one tried to help me. It was like I was contagious. And you could, you know, I think one of the sentences in the piece was, you could sort of see them all thinking, because we've just gone through COVID, look, you're putting a strain on the NHS. This is your fault. You don't have to be like that. You're taking up valuable space, not just on the pavement, but in our hospitals. And what I wanted to get across in the piece today was what a miserable existence it is being that overweight, because people just blame you for it. And I talked about all the many reasons you might be overweight, that it's hereditary. If your parents are tall, you're going to be tall. If your parents are overweight, it's the same likelihood that you'll be overweight. It could be medical. The heroine of my book, she has twins and she never loses the baby weight. I mean, my mum was very overweight, but she was in a wheelchair. She couldn't exercise. So there's lots of reasons for people being overweight. But the minute you sit down next to them, they huff and they puff and they move away. It's how people You know, if you're an overweight person, I don't think you'd ever go to the gym. I would never leave the house.
Yeah.
You know, we think that they have it in their control to lose weight. 95% of diets don't work. You don't put the weight back on. And it was so fantastic that today the news was broke about all this.
The food tax.
Recommendation.
Yeah, the snack tax, yeah. What was interesting as well, it's laugh out loud for us because we know, Liz, you are a size 8 normally when you're not wearing a suit like this, but you said you've got the waddle. You didn't have the faintest idea of what your feet were doing because they disappeared under the shelf of my mono boob and the Himalayan foothills of my stomach. But that is a daily experience for people who are that weight.
Yeah. You can't even see a curb. I found escalators and shops very difficult because they're very narrow and I couldn't see where the step was. So you immediately, within seconds, have all the gestures and the body language and everything of an obese person walking slowly, not being able to get in and out of a cab quickly, and all the cars behind are beeping because you're not fast enough. I couldn't move fast enough. And it was like the whole world was closed to me. Like even when I sat down to eat, I could see people looking at me thinking, well, why is she eating? Why is she eating? So you can't go in clothes shops. You can't go in lingerie shops. I couldn't fit in the cinema. The tube, the turnstiles are very, very narrow. And it was so hot. I literally had water running off my face.
Yeah.
We just need to be a little bit more kind to these people because it's not their fault they're overweight. It's the fault of the food industry, as Dimbleby says today.
Yeah, right.
It's the fault of the food industry. They did things to us. We didn't even know they were doing it.
I know. I think you're right. Other stuff here, you know, you say Harrods couldn't find a bra big enough for you.
I would have had to have a bra made to measure, which would cost £300.
Amazing. You couldn't sit in the cinema. You'd need two seats.
Yeah. And also you have all these people just looking at you. But it was because I'm so phobic about food and I've been anorexic all my life. I say I'm a recovering anorexic.
Yeah.
The reason I wanted to do this experiment and the reason I wrote the book is because I don't, once you start thinking about food, that's it for life. And I would rather that young women didn't think anything about food. They didn't think about their weight. They didn't think about, they just had interesting lives and they had fun and they'd go out and do stuff they're passionate about. The minute you obsess over food, that's it. You become either too thin or you overeat because you're so depressed. And there was one headline in the paper that said, oh, aren't plus size fashions encouraging and normalizing obesity? Well, you've got to wear something.
Yeah,
of course.
You've
got to go out. You've got to wear clothes.
Yeah. Next time a big fatso, if I can use that word, Liz, plumps next to you on a plane, maybe an EasyJet plane or a Ryanair where there never seems to be much room, are you going to be nice and charitable to them or are you going to think, oh my God, I've got a 3-hour nightmare journey?
No, I now know what it's like to walk in their very, very big shoes. And it's just awful. And we should just be kinder to these people because it's not their fault. It's all these society, the food industry, genetics. It's not their fault they're that size. They don't want to be that size. I didn't want to be that size. I couldn't wait to get back to the Daily Mail office and take it off.
Yeah, I wonder where it is now. Liz, fabulous piece, really hilarious. And do buy Liz Jones' new book. It's called 8½ Stone. And what size is she, your hero in the novel, Liz?
Well, she's a size 18, but
right.
Then she has a plastic surgery to make herself smaller because she thinks she'll be happier when she's thin.
Sounds great. That's Liz Jones, Daily Mail columnist and the author of, go and buy it, 8½ Stone. That's all we've got time for today for the latest from the Daily Mail. Download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.